And you have 15 minutes.
Thank you so much. First of all, I'd like to say I'm delighted that this talk is sponsored by the Committee on Women's Rights, because this is really a talk about women's rights, and I also believe it's critical that APHA have such a committee. It is not, however, an example of local action. It's really, I'm going to talk about what has happened at global levels, and then at the end, refer to how it is now being implemented at national and local levels. How many of you know, have heard of, have worked with a human rights-based approach to health? Okay, great. So the main point of this talk is going to be about how we operationalize that human rights-based approach, how we go beyond the abstract principles and concepts and make it meaningful to programmers and health system users in practice. I don't think I have to read this. I have no relationships to disclose. I was going to give you a little bit of the context of moving from ICPD to the Millennium Development Goals and the development of human rights-based approaches, but I think I really want to focus on the technical guidance and this particular tool and how it operationalizes HRBAs. So I'll whip through the context. Many of you probably know that it's almost 20 years since the International Conference on Population and Development really changed the paradigm from demographic imperatives to one based on reproductive rights. The following year in Cairo, that was built upon extensively. And the idea being that in order to empower women, we need to change social structures and social relationships, both in the private sphere of reproductive autonomy and freedom from violence, and also in the public sphere of access to resources, education, land, et cetera, very much echoing what Dr. Sankaran was just saying. The Millennium Development Goals, there was an enormous backlash against that political agenda between 1995 and 2000. The Millennium Development Goals took a very narrow, technocratic approach. I'm giving a whole nother talk on this, by the way, on Wednesday that goes into many more details about the politics of the MDGs. Focused on maternal health, specifically, not sexual and reproductive health. And only much later, as a result of really strenuous advocacy, was a second target added: universal access to reproductive health services. So the women's rights community justifiably felt certain alienation from the Millennium Development Goals and backed off. And there was a somewhat of a regrouping of actors involved in the MDGs and maternal health as a human rights issue. The Special Rapporteur on the Right to Health issued reports. There were mainstream human rights organizations like Amnesty and Human Rights Organization that came in specifically. Amnesty developed a global campaign, which I helped to design, on maternal mortality as a human rights issue, not something Amnesty International had done before. There's been a lot of path-breaking litigation at national and international levels, over 40 suits in India alone today, to establish a right to maternal health care, and a very high level of engagement by the Human Rights Council at the United Nations. So the Human Rights Council issued a thematic report first, and then the following year a best practices report, and last September this technical guidance on the application of a human rights-based approach, the first time that the Human Rights Council, through an intergovernmental process, had approved something that really went beyond kind of abstract guidelines to show policymakers, and in this case health policymakers, because it can really be applied in other fields beyond maternal mortality, or sexual and reproductive health, and it talks about sexual and reproductive health, not maternal mortality, really about what they need to do at every stage of the policy cycle. So it first sets out some general principles. A human rights-based approach is to health, not preventable maternal morbidity and mortality. That's very important. The end goal or outcome of interest is letting women live lives of dignity, not averting certain maternal deaths or morbidities. That we need to pay attention to social determinants of sexual and reproductive health. And we also need to look at health systems and consider health systems not as apparatus for the delivery of goods and services, but as core social institutions that are part of the fabric of our society. It also talks about these principles, accountability, non-discrimination, and equality, and participation, and what meaningful participation as opposed to formalistic consultation is. It then goes through the policy cycle, says, one, if you want a human rights-based approach, you need to have a national plan of action, a strategy, a national plan of action on sexual and reproductive health, which is multi-sectoral. I think we heard from Dr. Sankaran, if you want sexual and reproductive health, you need comprehensive sexuality education, for example. It requires sectors beyond the health sector. That plan of action should be based on evidence, should be based on a situational analysis. Sounds self-evident, but actually this does not happen nearly as much as it should happen. And the situational analysis should not just be on the epidemiological and demographic profile of the population, but should also be a review of the legal and policy framework, of the institutions and the institutional capacity necessary to implement the plan of action. That plan of action should pay attention to redressing historic patterns of discrimination and pay special attention to concern for marginalized and vulnerable groups, and should be done through a transparent and participatory process. So plans of action in much of the Global South are done behind closed doors. In fact, in this country, behind closed doors between donors and government technocrats. The people who are going to be affected, whose lives are going to be affected, have a right to know what is being discussed and have a right for the government to have to justify the decisions that they are making. In terms of budgeting, this technical guidance goes far beyond any other intergovernmental document that has been adopted by the United Nations. It talks not just about maximum available resources, and maximum available resources does not mean the 15% of the budget set out in the Abuja Declaration, which was a political declaration, not a legal declaration, but it talks about if the general budget increases, then there should be a presumption that if you have a high prevalence of sexual and reproductive health problems or of maternal mortality problems, the budget should increase. If the budget decreases, if this is a right, and women and adolescent girls are vulnerable groups, there should be some protection for that amount of the budget that goes to maternal health programming and sexual and reproductive health. And low-income populations should be afforded special protection. And courts in a number of jurisdictions have enforced these rules. Then it goes through ensuring implementation. So there's a huge breach often between what's set out in the policies and what happens in practice. We all know this. So it talks about a bottom-up diagnostic exercise. What's going wrong? Where is it going wrong? To whom is it going wrong? Why is this happening? Who's responsible? And how do we fix it? And it goes through two examples in quite a bit of detail: women arriving later failing to seek emergency obstetric care, and adolescents, maternal mortality and morbidity. And those two examples exemplify that a human rights-based approach are about proximate factors, the lack of an adequate supply chain for medications in the context of emergency obstetric care, and underlying factors. It talks about gender norms in adolescent maternal mortality and morbidity. Also a need to include health workers in ensuring implementation. Health workers, especially with this wave of concern about disrespect and abuse in care, which is absolutely, I mean, if you look at maternity wards in the Global South, they have a distinctly veterinary quality, but health workers have rights too, and if we make them the enemy, we will never achieve sustainable change. And accountability requires follow-up. I can't tell you how many programs I have evaluated, good-intentioned, where people identify problems, but there is no follow-up. So a human rights-based approach requires follow-up. In monitoring not just of quantitative outcomes, but of laws and policies and budgets, and quantitative indicators directed at measuring compliance with international obligations, which is not always the case in the indicators we choose. Monitoring should encompass private actors and should strengthen the health system. There are different forms of review and levels of accountability. We all know this. Judicial remedies are a crucial part of a human rights-based approach. Not the only part, but a crucial part. And by judicial remedies, I don't mean malpractice suits. I mean suits that can reform laws and policies, that can address systematic violations in practice, and we are now that can change budgetary allocations. We're now seeing a wave of judicialization in health across the world. The technical guidance goes beyond saying there should be remedies to saying you need to fund and provide for this from the start, from the National Plan of Action. There needs to be funding for access to justice, because otherwise it's all just words. So in conclusion, in terms of getting the technical guidance done, I would say, because I was the lead consultant on this, the involvement of multiple agencies was absolutely key, so that WHO and the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and UNICEF and UNFPA and the Partnership for Maternal, Newborn, and Child Health came together and invested heavily in getting this done and are now investing in the implementation of it. So we, for example, at Harvard have a project developing modular guidance for different stakeholders, because it's a different role if you're a health policymaker or a service provider, a National Human Rights Institution or a judiciary. So we now are involved in implementation of this guidance. An implementation report has been called for by the Human Rights Council in 2 years. Now it's less than one. It's September of 2014. And I also think it has relevance for post-2015. So there's all of this talk, I'm sure many of you have heard, about calling for the rhetoric of human rights to be incorporated into the next development framework. And that has been, in my view, largely rhetorical. We still have a lot of work to do on making sure that it's meaningfully incorporated, that metrics are appropriate to measure human rights aspects. But there will be a time after 2015 where people need to know, how would we implement this new Sustainable Development Goals framework in ways that are human rights supportive. And I think this technical guidance can do just that. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Alicia, first of all, for keeping the time and your remarks. And I just wanted to add that even without mentioning the phrase, you really covered respectful maternity care in your talk, because one of the issues is that women are not really respected when they're giving birth. And we'll learn more about that. But thank you. And also, as one of the NGOs involved with a lot of the post-2015 discussions, we have been really pushing for not to lose the momentum of specific health goals and targets, and also human rights. But again, it's a lot of rhetoric, and you know, all of you know that it's really hard to convince people there that this is in their best interest to put this in action. That being said, our next speaker, and why did this go blank? Okay, exit.